Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
It's Saturday morning, and it's time to talk about some more football in Western Pennsylvania and its contributions to the great game that we love. In this edition, we go through and review the significant early professional players and teams that called Western Pennsylvania their home. We have this story and more coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. As it was said at the top of the show, we're coming to you from Western Pennsylvania on the shores of Lake Erie. And Western Pennsylvania, I've been in my entire life, born and raised here, some 55-odd years here showing my age. And, you know, I'm very proud of our area, as well as many of us Western Pennsylvanians, of our game of football and our brand of football here and many stars. So we have this segment that we're reserving for each Saturday to discuss Western Pennsylvania football history. And we're going to talk about some early professional football in Western Pennsylvania today. Yet Western Pennsylvania is no stranger to professional football. Yes, when people first hear that, they immediately think of the modern and obvious choice of the NFL's Pittsburgh Steelers. That's true. They have been the dominant professional team of the last 80-some-odd years. But pro football on the sunset side of the Keystone State has been around for about 130 years. Heck, paying players to play ball with a pigskin, it actually started here in Western Pennsylvania. In this edition, we're going to go through and review the significant early professional players and teams that called Western Pennsylvania their home. And it all started with a guy named William Walter Pudge Heffelfinger, who was born on December 20th, 1867 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Yeah, I understand that. Minnesota is not on the western side of Pennsylvania. It is west of Pennsylvania, but not on the western side of Pennsylvania. Well, get this. His parents, Pudge Heffelfinger's parents, Christopher B. Heffelfinger and Mary Ellen Totten, were both born in Pennsylvania. So the roots are sort of start there, even though they were from York County, which is a little bit closer to Philly than it is to the western side of the Commonwealth. So as the story goes, Heffelfinger's father went by riverboat to Minneapolis, leaving York County, eventually joining the Union Army at the onset of the Civil War. He was wounded during that war in the Battle of Gettysburg, and after the war, he started the family shoe manufacturing business. And during Pudge Heffelfinger's lifetime, the family rose to prominence in Minneapolis, so much so that they could afford to give their children a very formal education, including their son, William. Now, William's nickname from a young age was Pudge, and Pudge played both baseball and football in high school in the Minneapolis area. Occasionally during his junior and senior years of high school, he also played for the University of Minnesota as a catcher for the baseball squad and a halfback for the Gopher football team. Great athlete, even as a youngster. And as he grew and became a pretty good-sized man of his time, the footballfoundation.org website bio describes Heffelfinger as being 6 foot 3 inches tall and weighing in at 195 pounds during his college age years. Originally, the lad had planned to further his education at the University of Minnesota. But in May of his senior year in high school, a local Yale alumnus who recognized his athletic talent and his great size convinced him to play for Yale instead. Yes, this Eli graduate tutored Pudge to the point where he could pass the challenging Yale entrance exam. On Heffelfinger's first day of freshman practice at Yale in 1888, the captain of the varsity team, Pa Corbin, spotted the menacing frosh on the field and gave him a position on the varsity line. He was raw, and his Midwestern upbringing on the gridiron did not have him mean enough to thrive in the East bludgeoning style of football. So he was groomed by a postgraduate assistant on there and learned some great technique and really got him a little bit angry and mean on that football field to play with a little bit of viciousness that really helped him in his college career. By the time the season of 1888 came around, Yale finished with a stellar campaign of 13-0-0, while Harvard was 12-1 and Princeton were 11-1. Yale was in its first season under head coach Walter Camp and sported an unprecedented scoring advantage of 694 points for and zero against. This dominant Eli 11 scored 126 touchdowns and kicked 69 goals from touchdown and 8 goals from the field or field goals. And his roster included, Pudge Heffelfinger, William Wurtenberg, Amos Alonzo Stagg, Lee McClung, Charles O'Gill, Frederick W. Kidd Wallace, Pa Corbin, John A. Hartwell, and Asheville Barney Newell. Yeah, Pudge went on to play a few more years. He was the best player on Yale and possibly in all of college football. But what an all-star squad for that time in football history, those late 1880s, just filled with some great names from history on there. And especially, you know, Amos Alonzo Stagg, we know, went on to be a fantastic coach. But McClung and Wallace and Corbin and Hartwell, great football players in their own right. Well, let's fast forward to the early 1890s. He graduated from Yale, Pudge did, and he was playing with the Chicago Athletic Association as an amateur who received a very common double expenses compensation. It really was not considered pay at that time if the organization merely compensated the individual for what it cost him to live in the area, plus a little bit more. So let's say double compensation. In our time, that's exactly what pay is, but just to make it a little bit grayer back in that era of football and era of the world. You know, the NCAA would greatly frown upon that nowadays if you gave somebody double compensation and said they were an amateur. Oh, well, anyhow, let's get back to our story. Meanwhile, in Pittsburgh, the area neighborhood sport clubs were forming in different locales and were challenging rival clubs in their area to play in competitive sporting events, including baseball and football. Soon, wagering started on these games, and as the pots grew, well, so did the desire to gain advantages over the opponents increase. On November 12, 1892, in what is now Pittsburgh, but a section at the time was called Allegheny City on the North Shore, the very first professional football game took place as Pudge Heffelfinger, yeah, our guy that we've been talking about, received $500 to become the first paid football player by the Allegheny Athletic Association, or AAA. Yeah, that AAA team, in fact, won the game 4-0 over the Pittsburgh Athletic Club, their rival, with great assistance from Heffelfinger, who scored the game's only touchdown, I believe. Now, the Allegheny Athletic Club, of course, denied paying Heffelfinger, and it went on for years. It was rumored he was paid, but never could be proved. And it was just recently, in the last decade or two, that some papers and a ledger came up from the Allegheny Athletic Club, came brought to light, and was taken to the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and it did prove that Pudge Heffelfinger was paid $500 to play for them. Very interesting indeed. But before that, you know, so for some 70 years or 80 years, 90 years maybe even, it wasn't proven that he was the first paid player. Many believe that it was actually a few years later, September 3rd, 1895, that the very first openly paid player in a football game was played, as quarterback John Brailier was paid $10 plus expenses to play for the Latrobe Athletic Association. Latrobe starting quarterback Eddie Blair had a prior commitment to play in a baseball game, so his Latrobe club approached a 17-year-old Brailier that was about to start school at Washington Jefferson College to play in his place. Now, Brailier was reluctant as he didn't want to get injured before starting a promising college career, so the Latrobe Athletic Club, they made it worth his while. Latrobe won the game 12-0 over rival Jeannette Athletic Association, and Brailier went on to have a great season at W&J, while also playing a few more games for Latrobe, too. The next season, after fielding offers from multiple colleges and clubs to play ball, he settled on playing for West Virginia University, and after only a few games for the Mountaineers, he left the team due to what he described as financial difficulties of the school not taking care of its players, and he returned to the Latrobe to coach and quarterback the club some more. in the late 1890s and early 20th century saw many professional teams sprout up, especially after the Athletic Association in 1896 was made up entirely of paid players, making it the sport's first ever all-professional team. Now, before too long, the best pro team in football in 1900 was most definitely the Homestead Library Club. And we've talked before about how William Chase Temple took over the Duquesne Country and Athletic Club, becoming the first individual team owner in professional football in 1898. But by 1900, most of the Duquesne Country Club and Athletic Club players were hired by Homestead Library and Athletic Club. And by offering them higher wages than their previous employer, they would go there because William Chase Temple, who was also a minority stake owner in a Pittsburgh Pirates baseball team, took over the payroll of that squad. So he knew all the players he paid before at Duquesne's country club. And then he went to the Homestead Library and Athletic Club. He brought the players with him and knew to pay him just a little bit more than he were getting over at Duquesne because he actually signed both contracts. Now, Temple paid his players a reported $50 to $100 per game, and results of this expense were clearly rewarded with the first of two undefeated seasons for Homestead. According to the Pro Football Hall of Fame's website, there was an NFL decades before 1922 when the American Professional Football Association changed its name to the National Football League. According to a timeline on ProFootballHOF.com, in 1902, some 18 years before the APFA, baseball's Philadelphia Athletics, managed by the legendary Connie Mack, and the Philadelphia Phillies joined the Pittsburgh Stars, along with another New York State team, the Watertown Red Blacks, to form a professional football group that they called, get this, the National Football League. Okay, we went in and talked about in 1902, there ended up being what was called a World Series of Football played at Madison Square Gardens right around New Year's Day, 1902, where the Madison Square Gardens was trying to make some hay, make a little bit of money, so they tried to put on a promotion of having an indoor football, having a smaller field with some teams that were invited. It was a pretty big success. I think the Syracuse Athletic Club ended up winning that by surprise over the powerhouse Philly team that they put together. And this became some big news of having mercenary players coming from other areas of the state and other states to come play for your football team. So another World Series of Football was organized for 1903 by Madison Square Gardens, but a new powerhouse that was paid had emerged. In 1903, north of Pittsburgh, two communities, Oil City and Franklin, both of western Pennsylvania, got into an escalating scandal for football supremacy over each other, which resulted in big money from Franklin going all in and hiring every substantial player from not only Pittsburgh's area, but also Philadelphia, too. They did this to prevent Oil City from being able to buy these players and put them on their team. So Oil City was sort of had nobody to put on their team professionally, and so they ended up not playing that game. We end up talking about that in the big feud in one of our scandals series on Oil City and Franklin. Well, the Franklin team was so stacked that they had trouble finding opposition. Not even the Pittsburgh and Philadelphia teams would play them very readily. They did get a few games here and there, but they just had so many great players, nobody wanted to play them. But they did end up winning the 1903 Football World Series with that powerhouse team. And so Franklin, Pennsylvania, another Western team, tops in pro football. Soon thereafter, professional football started shifting one state west as Ohio became the hot seat for players wanting to go. Now, Pennsylvania pro football had diminished to a handful of semi-pro teams and pretty much stayed that way until 1933, when Pennsylvania voters overturned a blue law permitting sports to be played on Sundays. This was big news for two new NFL franchises of the Philadelphia Eagles and the Pittsburgh Pirates, who would later be called the Steelers, and the NFL awarded franchises to both cities earlier 1933 based on the speculation that the PA voters would choose to repeal the Pennsylvania Sunday Blue Laws and in that year's general election. And that's exactly what happened, and that's how pro football got to be to where it is today. We're going to fill in more of the blanks from 1933 all the way up to today by talking about pro football. We're also going to talk some other levels of football with some great college teams and players that have emerged from this area as well. Well, that's the abridged story of Pennsylvania's early contributions to professional football, and we hope that you enjoyed it here, talking just a little bit more of the story, and we hope you learned as much as I did of researching this, because it's really a fascinating subject, and proud to be a Western Pennsylvania, and those of us that are really enjoy it, and I think everybody around the country really enjoys the story too. It's just a great story of how football and paid players developed. Hope you join back to us tomorrow for some more great football history. Next Saturday, we'll talk more on the Western PA football prominence and what it's done for football, and you know, the early roots of, not, you know, like we said, not just pro football, we'll go to the amateur level as well. And we can't wait to talk about more pro football with you tomorrow and each and every day right here on the Pigskin Dispatch. So make sure you check us out then. Until tomorrow, everybody, have a great gridiron day.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.